Welcome, everybody, to TNR Shorts, a quick flick from the next reel. I'm Pete Wright, and I'm here with Andy Nelson.
Hello.
This week marks the launch of Star Wars, The Force Awakens. In a legendary understatement, I'm here to report that the film is doing pretty well in the box office. You know that feeling you get when someone you know, someone you care deeply about, has something happen to them that is so spellbindingly awesome, so earth-shatteringly cool that you just can't help but feel your own life buoyed by their experience? That's the conversation we have for you today. I met D.C. Barnes and J. Trent Adams on the playground of Steele Elementary School 33 years ago this year. 32 years from our first meeting, thanks to a confluence of contests and nerd fate, these two were shipped to London to visit the set of The Force Awakens, to fill a walk-on role in the film, and to represent all of us fans as our ambassadors into the mystery box that is a J.J. Abrams film. Now, we've all seen the film now. Embargoes and NDAs are fully expired, and DC and Trent are here to share their experience on Star Wars The Force Awakens. DC and Trent Adams, welcome to the next reel.
Hello.
Hello.
And thank you for having us, Peter.
There you go. DC, nobody calls, thank you no for call, having nobody calls us. Me Peter.
DC and I are thrilled to be here. Dr. Wright.
That's better. So this thing started out as a result of a contest, the Omaze Force for Change contest. And I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this conversation, but I can say that I believe I'm the only one of the four of us that did not enter because I thought, what are the odds? I thought, how could it possibly even enter my orbit? That I would ever stand a chance to win. And here it is. You guys end up there is pretty demeaning.
DC, explain the story to him. Make him feel bad.
Tell me about the 3x5 cards.
So I feel exactly the same way that you do. Nobody wins those things. And I was not entering with that intention. I was interested in the crowdsourcing method that they were using. So in that method, they're like Kickstarter. There are different levels of rewards that you get. And one of those was a t-shirt that I thought was awesome, and I wanted to get that.
It was a good way to support the concept of what J.J. Abrams was doing vis-a-vis releasing the trailers. And that was, he kind of locked that into the contest format. The only way they were going to release media was in association with this foundation.
Now, I didn't know that. Tell me more. So that's why all of the little Easter eggs that we got in his on-set videos, that was all that he wouldn't have released anything had it not been for the foundation.
Right.
Well, he might have, but he would have found a way to do it.
He was a very genius marketing maneuver.
Well, that's the truth. The way I understood it is you go to the website, you enter to win, but there were other ways to enter.
I made a donation of $10.
And all I got was this lousy role in Star Wars The Force Awakens.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't get the t-shirt, by the way. After I won, I made a second donation to Force for Change and UNICEF, mostly because I felt it's not nice of me to win this with just a $10 donation. Okay, so that was the first part. And then the second part was that I went home and I watched this great movie, Punch Drunk Love. Part of the story is the main character is obsessed with winning this sweepstakes on pudding. He eventually does win it, and it's kind of a metaphor for his being freed from his mediocre life. I was inspired by that, and I went and I read the legalese on the Force for Change website. You have to go through a couple of different layers, but you can enter without donating money as well. The method was you send them a 3x5 postcard, and you have to cram all this information on there.
How many total did you prepare and send?
Okay, so I sent out, it was a few hundred.
Wow. Hundreds.
A few hundred.
Did you do that, Andy? Did you send a few hundred?
Sadly, no.
And that's why you're doing the interview tonight.
I got back in the mail probably a third of that.
Because the post office just rejected you.
Exactly. And then I also got, and I still have this, a handwritten letter from the postmaster telling me that the postcards are unacceptable. To be honest, I don't know how many actually made it to Omaze.
And they never told you this was the one that got you in. We particularly love this template, this
font.
This templated postcard that you sent.
Right.
Yeah.
I actually asked them that, and they said that they didn't know because they actually use a third-party company that does all the raffle part.
You got in. They notified you. Now we can sort of skip ahead. I will include in this in the notes here the link to the unveiling video. Now they punked you. This beautiful punking where they set up this whole thing with your work and they.
Ashton Kutcher was there.
Well, see, now you've just lied, right? He wasn't really there.
Yeah, okay, he wasn't right, really there, Ashton, but he punked
but
he, me.
But in the spirit of Ashton Kutcher, you were punked in the conference room, and they brought balloons, and suddenly you win. And get us then to how you brought Trent in line.
That night, after that video was made, I was pretty exhausted. I felt like I had just come down off a giant caffeine high. And so I was walking around the neighborhood.
I can only imagine.
And there's a park nearby, and I was walking through the park, and then I called Trent. And
Trent, had you seen the video by the time he called you?
It hadn't been released yet.
It hadn't been published.
All right,
no.
Go ahead.
So DC, the Grand Master that he is, calls me up and goes, "So, how free are you to travel? you got a passport around?" I'm starting to get kind of nervous about the conversation. I don't really know
because
what he's asking.
Because there are certain people in your life who you know one day is going to ask you to help you hide a body.
And this is the thing. It's like, how hard is it to get out of your family going to be okay if you have to leave for an extended period of time without knowing why?
That's a truncated version of the story.
I can only imagine.
I'm truncating, my friend, because otherwise we're going to be here for 4 hours. So let's see what we can do about speeding this conversation along.
Yeah.
So at any rate, end of the day, I say some vague things about I can travel. I travel for work all the time. And so, what. He goes, "Cool, I'm coming over to your house for dinner tomorrow," which is cool. So he shows up at our house for dinner. And the conversation kind of keeps going in these weird directions. And one of the things he says to me is, "So, what do you think of J.J. Abrams' reboot of Star Trek?" And of course, I say nice things.
Nice accent.
Well, that's you. That's how you
sound. Is that how I sound?
Everybody.
That's how you sound.
Really
everyone
sound
else.
That way?
Yeah. Yeah, that's how you sound. Everyone in the podcast is going to be listening to this going, "Oh, yeah, that was a dead-on
Didn't even
DC.
Know that Trent was talking.
He says, "Yeah, what do you think about JJ and Star Trek?" And I said, "Well, you know, it's pretty cool. I liked it a lot. I thought I liked what we did with it, blah, blah, blah." I said all sort of complimentary things. He goes, "Good. Right answer. I'll be right back." He disappears. He comes back in, and under his arms are these black T-shirts that he hands out to my kids and says, "Here, have some Force for Change shirts." At which point, I knew exactly what had happened. And I literally fell on the ground, like staring up at the sky. This is not a figurative literal, by the way. Not like literally fell on the ground. No. I literally fell on the ground.
He did actually fall on the ground.
This is the problem, and which has caused all sorts of marital strife later in my life here. Because like, what were you doing? Why was that so important to you? But whatever. We'll set that off to the side and say I was staring up at the sky, stars twinkling around my brain. And it turned out that later, I looked through the little rules of the thing, and DC said, "Let's go. I want to take you with me on this trip." And so literally what I heard was, "I want to go with you to London. I will then stand there and watch you be in Star Wars." And that was cool enough for me because I was actually a total fan of DC getting this opportunity, and I was just geeked out by just,
of course,
being around. So then I read the thing later, and it said, you and a friend get to both be in the movie. And at that point, I had a second bout of explosion going on in my head. Talked to DC, and he goes, "Oh, yeah, that's the, you know,
oh,
what
you
were
you
thinking
didn't get
thing
that?
Was.
That's the whole thing, man.
Yeah, I thought it was just going to be a friend and be cool and whatever, but it turned out to be so much more than that. So, yeah. Now, the coolest part of this next piece of the story is they never gave us enough information. They never told us what was really going to happen at any given point in time and all of this. So we end up finally sort of getting a hotel reservation kind of done, and we get some plane tickets. We're cool to go. We're literally at the airport trying to figure out how we're actually going to get from the hotel to Pinewood. We don't know. So DC pops open his phone and tosses off an email to the Lucasfilm guys and goes, "We're going to meet at the Pinewood Studios at 9 in the morning on Thursday. Okay, see you there." We click send. when we board the plane. Because what we had done is we had gone through the exercise of Google mapping and found out that from our hotel, we could take the Piccadilly line to Uxbridge. And then from Uxbridge, we could actually walk the 2 miles to Pinewood.
Oh, yeah, you were trying to like hostel it. Like, you were really on your own.
We didn't know what to do. So we were just like,
we're not going to rent a car. We're not going to hire a taxi. No, dude, we're going to walk from the train station to Pinewood Station. Knock on the door. Hello. Hi, yeah, we're extras. Can you let us in? That'd be cool. And so at any rate, we land. And by the time we land, DC opens his phone and goes, oh, wait, never mind. They're going to send a car for us. That set up the stage. The car picked us up in the morning and dropped us off at our trailer.
Wait. You had a trailer.
No, DC?
Trailer.
Did we or did we not have a trailer?
It went like this. We get out of the car. There's a couple of people there to meet us, some very nice Brits. And they're like, okay, well, why don't you just take them over to their trailer and we'll go get security. So we were like, trailer?
Okay. You're a star, you get a trailer.
So they walked us through this Tornado Bay collection of trailers. And there was our names next to the door of this production trailer. So we went in.
And we then later find out that, you know, like Daisy Ridley, John Boyega's, Judah Freelander's trailers were all in this right. same area. Some of the people were too cool for this trailer park and apparently had a really fancy trailer park somewhere else. But these were the crew we were hanging with.
Right.
And yeah, it was really cool. In fact, the last time we got to take any pictures on set, because everyone's always asking, oh, let me show the pictures. We're like, yeah, let me show you the exact one picture we have. It is of DC standing in front of his trailer. Because then after we took that picture, the production assistant came over and goes, cameras, please.
And then you lose your phones for the duration of your
that
onset
was
time.
The, that, that was it.
Okay, so you're at Pinewood, you're in your trailer. Walk us through your experience on the set. And you know, I should add, there's another video we're going to post on there, that not just the launch video, but they did post kind of a cool summary video that ended up being wildly touching. I think I watched it 100 times myself. It was of your experience kind of getting the tour through the set, but it was way too abbreviated. So you've got to tell us about the experience of being on a Star Wars set after all these years of being in front of one.
With real things, not just CG stuff everywhere.
That's true. I don't know if we saw any blue screen at all. There was a little bit around the edges of the set where they could then expand the sets up, but that was it.
Sure.
That was it.
And it also at the ends of corridors. So there were like some 360 sets we were in. There were ends of corridors. There's like you'd turn a corner. Oh, blue screen. Right. Because they're like, oh, well, I got
you know what? I can
thing.
Only imagine right. if you're listening right. to this and wondering about the role itself. And so can we start with the costuming? Because I think if I recall, that's sort of the first place you went, at least in the video. They walk you in to show you who you're going to be.
Actually, yes. They took us straight to costuming and makeup before they gave us a tour. So after the costume, we went on tour of various sets. Mm-hmm. In that video, I've got makeup all over my face, which makes me look weird in those videos. But
yeah, because that's what makes you look weird.
So we go into, they take us into a big warehouse with temporary walls, and they bring us into a room, and we meet costuming people.
Designers.
Sorry, a costume department.
Right. They show us some paintings of our characters, and they're like, we're gonna make you up to look like this.
They had done actual paintings of you guys who are in the film for not very long.
They'd even painted our faces into these, they're like watercolors.
Did they give those to you?
No, and I asked for them.
We wish we had a copy, though. That'd be cool.
Do you remember what happened when I asked for them, Trent?
Other than they laughed?
Yeah,
I know
they laughed.
Yeah.
They laughed.
Yeah.
All of
At
them.
At first, they thought he was kidding. And they're like, oh, that's great. Oh, wait, what? And then they laughed harder.
Yeah. They laughed in my face like, no, what are you crazy? No, of course not. Of course not. This costuming went on for a while. And then in comes an American fellow who we didn't know who it was.
No, we did. Oh, we did know him. He was very important.
Well, later we found out who he was.
At the time, we did not.
At the time, we did not. But
Look,
later
it's
we
Michael
found
Kaplan,
out.
Michael Kaplan, Oscar award winning costume designer. Right. And we're like, hi, Mike. Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
And then we gave him a hard time constantly. We're like joking with him. And he was looking at us
I
like.
I did not give him a hard time.
Well, I'm sorry. That's my job. My job is to give people a hard time. I was giving him a hard time, and he was just looking at me like, "What's wrong with you?" And then the rest of the costume department, who of course know who he is, are looking at us going, "Whoa, what are they?"
They were a little. they seemed a little. They seemed very respectful of him.
Well, rightfully so. Literally, the last day on set, DC and I flipped up our phones and checked up who these cats were that we'd been dealing with all week. Turns out Michael Kaplan, Oscar award winning costume designer for Blade Runner. And we just are my head.
I think it's a BAFTA award, actually.
Yeah, it's a BAFTA.
Note to self, maybe you check those things on day one.
How about before we go? Because when I met Daisy Ridley and John Boyega, I didn't know who they were.
Oh,
I did. I didn't know who they were.
I didn't. And so Morgan Dameron, who's our handler on set, says, "Hi, this is Daisy Ridley." She's like, "Oh, so nice." And I'm like, "Oh, you're cool. You're in the movie. That's neat." And then John Boyega, we're having this night grace conversation, and then we're walking away from it. And I say, "Well, DC, he seemed like a really nice guy. He'd be kind of cool, you know." And he's like, "Well, yeah, he's." And he tells me who he is.
Those are the main characters.
The main characters of the film.
I should have brought a Star Wars fan with me.
Too funny.
Yeah.
So they put us all in these costumes, and it took a couple hours to do. And they made changes, and they made notes about their changes. My costume stayed pretty much the same as they had designed. Trent's costume changed drastically, actually. Michael Kaplan came in and was like, "Well, I think it should be like this and like that." And he basically created a new entire costume right there on the spot. It was pretty impressive. What happened next? We went to makeup.
Yeah. We went to makeup. They messed around with, and that's what you see in the reveal film. They mess up and they mess with DC's face, and they try to make him look like a Harkonnen, which was the wrong film genre, franchise, but they tried anyway. They basically looked at me and said, "Just don't shave for a couple of days." And that was the end of that.
Oh, so they made you beard up.
I've been wearing this goatee since I was, 28. And all they said was, "Just rough it up a bit." Like, so you're saying just look
with
like
a British accent.
That's how all British people sound.
Rough it up a bit,
actually.
Would you mind?
So, they did put a scar on the side of your face, I remember, but then it was covered up by goggles.
Funky goggles.
And you can really see that scar from the 50 feet away from the camera we are for the exact 28 frames when we're on.
Okay, so you are, just please set the stage for where people can see you before we move on to the next scene. This is
in Maz's temple, right? You guys ended up in that scene as bar patrons?
Right, bar patron. We actually got a tour of that set first, and it was empty. It was just the room, and they hadn't dressed it yet.
Well, it wasn't really empty because there were some patrons already there. They were just kind of slumped over like this.
There were some animatronic characters, but all the camera gear wasn't in there when we were toured around. That's the scene right when thinking back when Han Solo and Rey and Finn come into the castle. They go through the doors, and he's like, "Don't stare at anything." And then there's kind of this montage of what's going on inside the castle. That's where we are.
Were you guys sitting at sitting at the same table, right? Just the two of you, or what were you guys doing?
So we shot some background stuff of just standing, and then there was another scene that they shot that got cut out of the movie. And that scene was, we're standing around a 5x5 table, us and a bunch of aliens and other humanoid type people. And we're gambling on some kind of game that we didn't see because they were going to add it in later.
Yeah, we were asking them the rules. We're like, okay, so we're supposed to be betting on this. What are the rules? And standing next to us is one of the other extras was the, like, puppet master of this whole scene, and he goes, "Well, we haven't figured that out yet, so just make it look good." So the extras got together, and we all said, "Okay, well, what are we going to do, and how are we going to bet?" And so we kind of came up with these rules of betting on the fly, which, by the way, one of the guys who was in the Vanity Fair photo of this cast of characters looks like Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. He just kept winning. It didn't matter what we did, he would always win, and he decided he was always going to win. So it was like,
we didn't know how to play the game. And then after a round, which meant that they said cut, he would declare, "Oh, I won that round," and we'd be like, "What do you mean you won?" He's like, "Oh yeah, I won. Just wait till the next round." which means when they call action again, and then he'll win again.
Extras,
yeah,
man.
No, and extras. These were the professional extras, and it was really hilarious when we were filming filming the scenes, because it was very obvious they knew what they were doing. So as an example, when you see the scene 57 minutes in, right, you're in the castle, and there's a pan across the room, and there's this giant fire pit in the middle. Not kidding, giant fire pit. Real fire, giant, yeah. Very hot. And we're wearing basically these really elaborate carpets wrapped around us that look really cool. They're not cool. They're very hot. But
they're very hot.
And incredibly, and we should get back to talking about that at some point, the costumes. They were so incredibly detailed and immaculate and fit so well. I've never worn clothes that fit that well, literally. Anyway, we're standing there in this giant room, huge fire. And it's hot as you can possibly imagine. We're boiling, literally boiling.
And we're standing right next
to it. Yeah, I mean, sweat's pouring off of us, and I have these goggles on. I can't see anything, and they're steaming up, and I'm like about to fall over. And we notice after every time they call cut, the real extras just kind of disappear. And we don't know where they went. And we're standing there like, oh, what are we doing? Oh, it's so hot. And then we look over, and at some point DC goes, wait a minute, they're all huddled in that corner. Over there. Right.
There was a corner where they had pumped in an air conditioning
for the extras, and nobody told you.
No, they didn't tell us. I mean, why would they? You
know, they're just, no, two things they didn't tell us about. So number one is they didn't tell us about that. And so when DC finally figured out, I was like, aha, look, cold. Then the second thing they didn't tell us about was what to do. The production assistant brought us onto set. So we get all kitted up. We've got our costume wrangler, and our costume wrangler's following us around and making sure that everything's exactly the way it should be all the time. And he's kind of like fussing about us. And the PA says, okay, stand here in this middle of the scene.
Actually, it was, why don't you stand in this area?
Stand right now. Exactly.
Just.
Why don't you stand here?
Okay. And then they left.
So she walks off, and so DC and her are like talking to each other, like, do-do-do-do-do. And the next thing we hear is, action! and undoubtedly, if that take exists anywhere, it's there's two extras standing there staring at each other like complete idiots.
This was also the scene, obviously, with Lupita Nyong'o, who was pretty dramatically cut from what I've read.
I would say that everything that we saw, which included Lupita and Harrison and Ray and Finn, Daisy Ridley and John Boyega, and everything we saw in Maz's castle, probably only 20% of it ended up on the screen. So there was a lot that was shot with and without Lupita. A lot of stuff. I mean, there's so much in that scene, and they did multiple takes of coverage of everything. So whoever's got the archive on that footage,
was there? And I don't want you to spoil anything if you're still under NDA. But is there anything in what you saw that would impact the way we perceive the story?
It would have changed some of the thematic beats.
Yeah, I'd say yes. You know,
there's something that happens a little ahead in some of the scenes we saw that didn't make it onto film, and that may have played into why they were cut. It didn't fit the beat that they wanted to hit.
Interesting.
Yeah, it might have been too early of a reveal for the plot.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see on the deleted scene, though, to see that whole piece come together, because we saw two really elaborate pieces that didn't make it. One was kind of a fun joke piece that we were a part of, and then another was kind of an interesting story thematic piece that was reasonably complicated, at least complicated enough that they had to rehearse it, with some prop masters for about a day and a half.
Like an action sequence?
No.
Not that. Yeah, it was a bit that wasn't just a couple of guys talking.
You know, I don't want you to risk your position in episode 8. So you mentioned the costumes are particularly elaborate. Tell us more about that.
They were surprisingly elaborate. What I had expected was that they were going to throw some rags on us, some robes, and say, okay, stand here in the background. You know,
I thought we might still be able to see your TK421 t-shirt logo like under your robes.
Oh,
no.
You thought it had been like those Planet of the Apes costumes where you were the apes with just the really cheap masks in the back that didn't actually...
Right. That's what I kind of thought. I honestly thought that, but that wasn't the case at all. You know, they went to 11 on these costumes.
They designed these things specifically for us, B, they tailored them exactly to our specifications. But they were so detailed. I mean, and this was true about the whole our whole experience on set. Everything was detailed to the nth degree. And knowing that it will never be seen, just know, if you know it'll never be seen on screen, but yet at the same time, everyone went all the way to the most, the highest detail they possibly could. And so our costumes, same thing. You never see more than, you know, I don't know, the top third of us. And there was a full kit under this with full, the outfit goes all the way to inner tunics. I mean, inner tunics, outer tunics. Everything and by the way, everything has got our names stitched and embroidered into them.
Wow!
So they're essentially ours. You know, they've got our names embroidered into them, all the way to the gloves and the boots and the pants and the shirts, the under tunic, the outer tunic. Our names are in them, and they're in a Lucasfilm archive somewhere.
Wow.
Because again, as we were walking out the door, we're like, "Well, hey, could we have these?" And they said, "Yeah, no." And then we got this image in our heads of Indiana Jones, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark, the final scene. No, that's where we, you know, they're in the Lucasfilm, you know, warehouse. And at some point or another in this whole exercise, they scurry us away into this room where they laser scan us and take these photographs of us in a whole, you know, a 350-degree camera studio to preserve the costumes. To do two things. One is if they ever need to recreate them, they have these really high-resolution media captures of them. And then secondarily, they stood us on a turntable and spun us while this laser was shooting at us so that they could create digital files. So they've got a digital file that they could, if they wanted to, ship to their friends down at Hasbro if they would want to make the three-pack of bar patrons.
Which would be perfectly okay. Right. Why us?
Which,
yeah.
And you know, I mean, fans eat up every toy that gets out there. So,
did you have character names beyond like bar patron?
This is actually a really interesting story. So we do the costumes and the makeup, and they take us to the around to the different locations, and then to an actual set where they're shooting, which is in that video. You see us, you see the stormtroopers and J.J. Abrams in that video. And then as we're leaving, we meet this gentleman named Andrew Jack. And he's the dialect coach for the characters. As you know, John Boyega has an American accent in the movie.
But he's very British.
He's actually a Brit. Yeah, he's a Brit. So we strike up a conversation with this guy, and he's a super fascinating person. The next day we were at lunch, I think, and he comes up to us and starts talking to us again. And we're like, the short story is we make friends with this guy. And he is also actually a character in the movie. He's one of the resistance commanders.
Isn't he the one who says, wait.
He says, it's another Death Star.
That's his line.
That guy with the white hair.
Oh, right, yeah.
And then he was totally shut down and said, shut up. This one's so much bigger. Let's show what you just said next to what really is, and then you see what you think.
Right. Basically.
And that was the accent
that's
right.
So, yeah, that's exactly good. Right.
Right. We finished shooting our background stuff, and then they were going to shoot the gambling scene. So they had taken us back to get our makeup touched up because it had basically melted off us standing next to that fire. And Andrew Jack comes up to me and he says, would you be comfortable saying a line for this next scene? And I was like, I'll do whatever you want. You know, I am in nice. Your hands.
This is the time when somebody says, would you like a line in Star Wars? You say yes.
Yes. So I said, yes, absolutely. I'll do whatever you say. And he's like, okay, I think we can come up with something. He goes away and he comes back and he has this line written in this alien language that he just came up with. And I don't know if it was him or J.J. Abrams or someone else who instigated this, but I...
Lawrence Kasdan, he was hanging on set. So
he was
there
too.
That was a nice drop too.
Yeah, you know.
I was like, okay, I'll say this. And it's an alien line and it goes, Rai Katakoyo Rai. And I'm supposed to snarl it at the camera because of
some action.
There's a bit of action going on.
Yeah.
So then we go and shoot that scene, and then the Star Wars adventure ends, and we come home back to Denver. And I get this email, I think it was from you, Pete, who said you'd looked at IMDb. And so I looked on IMDb, and there was my name in the Star Wars credits, and they had my character name was Katakoyo, which is the line that Andrew Jack had asked me to say in the movie. So I was like, oh, wow, I get a character name. Oh, that's awesome. That's rock bottom awesome. So then some time goes on, and then just the other day after the press screening, the real credits came out, and they had changed it to bar patron. So I got demoted from having a character name.
And
to
did they misspell
patron.
Your name in the credits?
Yeah, they did, but that's who's going to quibble over that? No, who cares?
No, I already have an attorney on the phone. I think we're going to do a little litigation to try and get that some remuneration for that extra E.
So much for the NDA.
So that's how that name came and went.
But at least you can always say that you own that. Katakoyo.
Katakoyo, right. Andrew Jack had written this thing out on a little piece of scrap paper for me to memorize my lines. So I still have that.
This was your entree. Were you directed at this point by JJ himself?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that experience, about meeting and working with him.
He has a really interesting way of directing the real actors. For us, it was just very simple and basic. Like, I want you to do this, stand here, you're gambling, et cetera, et cetera. It was very straightforward. But he did have a very interesting way of directing the other actors, the real actors. We watched a scene with John Boyega and Daisy Ridley, and they were, the camera was on one of them. You know how they did a shot and then a reverse shot. So it was on one of them, and it was a subtle scene, and he would go up and he would give notes to the actor that was not on camera. So the person who was on camera could then react to, the other person. So it wasn't, which I thought, well, that's really clever. If acting is reacting, et cetera, then he can change somebody's performance by changing the way that they're reacting to. So I thought that was just one. I'm sure he's got a million tricks up his sleeve, but that was one thing that I found particularly interesting.
I thought one of the interesting tricks was when we saw him directing Harrison Ford, and so he and Harrison Ford were talking about one of his lines, and Ford goes, "All right, I get it. Yeah, I get it." And so JJ goes back. They call action. They shoot the scene, and Harrison Ford performs the line totally differently than what they just talked about. And nothing to do with nothing. And so JJ lets it play out, and then he calls cut, and he goes back up to talk to Harrison Ford. And he's very calm, and he's like, "Well, that's great. It's really good to play with it. But all right, let's try going back to kind of this other idea. Let's see if we can go back. All right, I've got it. Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to try that. All right, we got it." So he goes back. Cuts, calls action. Ford does it the way he wants to do it again. This happens three times, and after the third time, Abrams just looks at the cinematographer and just kind of shrugs. It's like, I guess we got what we got. So the other way he likes to deal with it apparently is, when Harrison Ford does his lines, that's what you get.
That's what you're gonna get.
But and I think that J.J. Abrams is intelligent enough to know. Who knows Han Solo better than Harrison Ford? So if Harrison Ford wants to do it the way
Han
Solo does,
interestingly, he did sort of seal the deal for old Harrison in this film anyway.
What now, was that because of Harrison Ford wanting to do that? Or?
No, I think it was because he couldn't take direction. That's my theory.
It's just like,
that's it.
You're going to be the hero of all three films.
you really don't do what I tell you. So.
We've got this Jar Jar Binks guy's phone number.
Okay, two
oh,
more.
Oh, man.
Bring in the Jar Jar.
Well, you guys were on set with Lupita Nyong'o, as you already mentioned. But I think it's interesting, her character, and speaking of Jar Jar Binks and going back to kind of the prequels, CG characters, her character, mm-hmm. At least from my eyes watching the film, is like one of the primary CG characters in the film, definitely in that bar. At least that's how she definitely appears. I mean, how was that character of Maz on set? And was Lupita there? Was she, marked up with all the little bubbles and everything to do the motion capture? And
She was. That's not a CGI character. It's a mocap character. So it was actually made done with two actors. Lupita did the face and probably the neck and shoulders. And then they had a little person who did the body. Her name was Artie Shaw. Mm-hmm. So they would shoot. This was kind of interesting. They would shoot the scene with Lupita and Harrison and Daisy and John. And then they would reshoot the exact same scene with Artie being the bottom half of that character.
Yeah, Lupita is not exactly the size of Maz.
No, no, no. And actually, Artie isn't either. That character's considerably smaller than even Artie.
Yeah, and the way, in fact, that was the interesting thing that they did. So, you know, Pete, you asked earlier whether or not there was a lot of green screen or blue screen work, and you know, the set we were primarily in, the Maz's castle set, it was a 360 set. There was no green screening other than kind of at corridor ends. So that they could have freedom of movement. And when we were in there, the ability for the camera to move and do whatever it was essentially untethered, except for then there were a couple of shots which they had to, you know, do these tracking shots on, to ensure that they were capturing it right. And one of the things they had to be really careful was the Lupita's character, was the Maz character. And Artie was wearing this suit, and we got to talk to her quite a bit about, well, you know, what's on the suit. And it turns out she's actually a stand-in for quite a few characters, and I can't remember the long list of them, but she would say, oh, yeah, well, I was this, and I was this, and, you know, so she's got it down. In fact, she was the raccoon in Guardians of the Galaxy.
No kidding.
Whatever this character is. And so we talked to her about how she was able to do that because she's actually not the same size. And so it turns out that the outfit she wears is tuned with these stripes and these special patterns to indicate for the cameras what needs to be done. And so so one of the things that one of the guys told us was, yeah, there's going to be some CGI in this, but rather than adding stuff in, they're going to do a lot of extraction and removing things out. So some of the characters, which, by the way, they described a scene to us that I don't think made it into the set, where they dress up animals and have them running around in set, and they had to have a geese. That's what it was, and they had to have a guy shepherding and herding these geese through this kind of to perform this kind of action, and he's wearing a blue suit or something, and so that they could pull him out of the scene and it yet still, sure, you know, have these dressed up geese running around, practical geese. So this kind of thing, and one of the things I was joking about the other day is that the sets were so detailed, you know, everything in there is just so where it needs to be, but it was kind of a messy set. It was kind of and so we sat down at one point, we were waiting for something to happen. We sat down in the chairs that were there. So there's chairs, you sit down in them. And I started looking at the stuff that was just kind of like laying around, and yeah, you can't move that stuff. That stuff is all glued down. It is not moving.
Yeah.
So it was actually kind of cool. Number one is so detailed and incredibly, you know, highly complex stuff. Oh, yeah, and you can't pick it up, which I'm sure was a good thing that we couldn't.
Well, especially because you were there. Yeah.
Right.
But the one last thing that I think would be interesting for your fans to know about
listeners,
the sets.
Yeah. Trent, I have no idea if they like
us. They're your fans, dude. They
listen.
I mean, come on.
They're very gracious with their time.
All three of them come back every week.
They're tolerance at best.
I'm a listener.
So the two other fans you have will be interested in this because this one already knows. So when we were wandering around in the Millennium Falcon, as you do, we were sitting down in the chairs, and DC looks over and kind of starts looking at this bubble wrap on there. And it's like, well, what's this? We're talking to Morgan Dameron, the woman who's kind of shepherding us around, and says, oh, well, you know, those are the seatbelts in the Millennium Falcon. So the couple of takeaways here. Number one is, by the way, the Millennium Falcon has seatbelts.
So there's never knew that. That's new.
So there's that. Secondly, they're so concerned about your safety in the Millennium Falcon that the seatbelts have bubble wrap.
They bubble wrap you down.
And so we were talking to them about this, like, why do these seatbelts have bubble wrap on them? And she's like, well, you know what? We really don't know. But we made the detail of the Millennium Falcon recreation so close to the original because they had bubble wrap on the seatbelts in the original Millennium Falcon set. We haven't.
Wow.
We don't know why, but we're making it
go
so
back
complete.
Go back to the Blu-rays and watch as Ben Kenobi puts the seatbelt on. You'll see that there's a stripe of bubble wrap on it.
Can you talk about your experience just briefly walking onto the Millennium Falcon for the first time? Both of you, it feels like you had a religious experience, and luckily you had an EMT with you.
I did have to resuscitate him. There's a brief blackout of the video.
What was that like?
I had to resuscitate him.
So I did, as you saw in that video, I didn't make it up the ramp. It was really overpowering. And I know that sounds stupid and childish, but to see that set in that detail and that level of realism after, you know, decades of watching it on, you know, video was, it was really overwhelming. And I actually, they cut some of that out. I actually walked completely out of the set and just had a sit down for about 30 seconds and then came back up because, you know, the Lucasfilm documentary crew was there and they were filming me the whole time. So I didn't want to look, you know, like they had to like push my tears back and get my breath and like regain my composure. But I'll tell you what it was like. It was like being punched in the stomach. It was like all the air went out of my lungs. And so I retreated.
It's amazing.
So cool.
Yeah. Amazing is, it certainly was.
How many days were you guys on set?
So we were scheduled to be there for 3 days.
We were supposed to be there for two. We were supposed to be there for costume fitting on day one and studio tour. And the second day we were supposed to go and shoot our scenes. That's the way it was designed. Right. 2 days on set.
However, we weaseled our way into five total.
Five.
So
nice.
So
was it like, we were in the background of that scene. For continuity, shouldn't we stay here?
Yeah, weasel is probably the wrong word. We were invited to stay longer, I guess. Part of it was one day we spent a good time just sitting there watching them shoot. And Morgan came up to us and was like, "Are you guys okay just sitting here?" And we were like, "Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is our dream come true." And she's like, "Okay, well, you guys have been like completely like non-disruptive. So I'm just going to leave and do this other tour right now. But you guys just hang out here." And we're like, "Oh, okay. Thanks." And she's like, "Yeah, if you guys want to come back the next day or whatever, that's great too." And we were like,
"Okay,
well, absolutely, absolutely." Well, by the way, who do you have to go give a tour to? She's like, "Oh, Benedict Cumberbatch," and then she walks away. And we were like, "Huh?" So then we're sitting there. 20 minutes later, in walks Morgan, and in walks Benedict Cumberbatch. She was given the same tour.
Well, but I think what's interesting is that, you know, day one when we were on set, Morgan and company were really just on top of us. They're like, "Right, you know, this is what we're doing." Next day, the way it worked was J.J. Abrams actually was confused and he thought we were supposed to be back on set the next day. And so he said, "Oh, hey, you know, we'll see you tomorrow." And he walks off. And of course, we turned to Morgan and we're like, "Hey, J.J. said we'll see you tomorrow. So we'll see you tomorrow." And she was like, "Okay, fine. We'll send a car for you." And so the next day, she's leaving us alone a little bit more. She's just checking in, making sure that we're not a bunch of doofuses and we're like running around talking to Benedict Cumberbatch. And so, you know, we're not. And then, you know, it turns out we had to come back for costume fitting, you know, on a third day. And we said, "Hey, can we just hang out the rest of the day?" They're like, "Yeah, fine." And they're starting to get used to us by this point, such that they just kind of would look around every half an hour, 45 minutes, make sure we were still there.
Make sure you were there.
And then that was it. And then after that, they're like,
"Good behavior really pays off." Now.
Final story. Can you tell us about meeting Harrison Ford for the first time?
So, first of all, he's really nice guy. He's super laid back, calm. I was going to swear there, but he's cool as, you know, fill in the blank. So when we first met him, we were, it was outside the castle set that's been destroyed and they get into a gun battle at that point. So they were prepping for this and it was muddy and it was raining. And it's, you know, it's England, so it's raining.
You're outside, in Pinewood or where you were outside? It was an exterior set.
Yeah, this is on the back lot of Pinewood and it's outdoors and there's trees all around us. And then the castle set, destroyed castle set. We're standing there. And Trent nudges me. So I look to my side, and there goes Harrison Ford right by us. Full Han Solo outfit, walking through the mud.
I would have been laid out. I would have passed out.
He's there. He's just wandering around waiting for the movie to start shooting and just eating an ice cream, bowl of ice cream in the rain. So he goes over, and he finishes his ice cream, and then we meet J.J. Abrams, and we talk to him for a little bit. And then he introduces us.
JJ introduces you to.
Right. To him. And he was, I thought he was very nice and polite. And obviously he knew that we were some kind of tour.
He knew we were some kind of like tour because of the bad robot hats we had we were told to wear them, and then we find out later, by the way, that's the giant signal to everybody else on the set that we're important.
Ooh.
Somehow he knew.
Nice.
JJ said, "Oh, these are the Omaze winners and they're going to be in Maz's castle scene." Actually, he didn't use that word. He said Hall of Mirrors scene, because that was the Poppo code word. And he says, "Oh, so they're not just dead stormtroopers then." And we're like, yeah. Oh, so that was cool. Yes. So he was very nice to us. And then do you want to tell him about the boots, Trent?
So yeah, so that's DC's version of what
he was very nice to me, and I thought
he was very nice to DC because DC was
polite.
You know, polite and quiet and calm and collected. Whereas I looked over at him and I said, well, it's good that you got the memo and that you're wearing wellies, because it was really muddy there. And we had not gotten the memo, and we had shown up in boots, in our shoes, that were just totally covered in mud, like destroyed. And we're sloshing through this mud. And Harrison Ford, of course, is wearing these boots that are just perfectly fine for walking around in the mud. And so I look at him, I'm like, "Oh, you got the memo, you're wearing your wellies." He looks at me with a steely grin and goes, "They're not wellies. They're just boots." And he walks off. Like, you're cranky. I mean, come on. I was, you know, that being said,
I was watching this whole happen and I thought it was hilarious.
Of course it's hilarious that Harrison Ford's giving me a hard time, which seems to have played itself out because
the roles were reversed.
Because no one ever gives me a hard time. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
This is the role of a lifetime, guys. Have your lives changed? I mean, now that the paparazzi are calling you and your local papers, and
you're the biggest celebrity media mogul who's called.
I'll take it. I will take that. This has been a real treat. Thank you so much for taking the time to hang out with us and share the story. DC Barnes, Trent Adams.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Very exciting.
All right. So, episode 8. You hanging out with Mark Hamill. I want to hear the story then, too.
I think we should have another episode of this podcast when the Blu-rays come out and we can do some still framing.
Count on it. Let's do it.
There you go.
Pull it apart. Thank you so much, guys. Andy, on behalf of Andy Nelson, DC Barnes, Trent Adams, I'm Pete Wright. We'll catch you next time on The Next Reel.